Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing the state of political reporting at a time when the U.S. is facing so many issues, including attacks on democracy, the pandemic, the climate crisis, voter suppression, rising inequality, and so much more. So how are the media covering these pressing issues? We will also talk about the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, which would transform the lives of millions of people, and we've done a lot of shows about that. Joining us are two veteran journalists. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of several books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you and great to be with Dan.
Great to have you. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch. Dan wrote the daily White House Watch column for the Washington Post during the Bush administration and then served as Washington bureau chief and senior writer at Huffington Post covering the Obama administration before working as Washington editor with The Intercept. Hi, Dan. Great to have you back.
Hi, it's great to be here. And yes, I am so hugely happy to be with John Nichols. I can't tell you.
Well, we are hugely happy to have both of you on together. I want to start off with you, Dan. As I said, you can't, and there's so many issues that we're facing right now. We just did a show yesterday about how to fight very high healthcare bills. And you wrote a lengthy piece for Press Watch and your mission statement called Political Journalism Needs a Reset. You write, no one can possibly argue that modern political journalism has fulfilled its essential mission of creating an informed electorate. So it's long past time for a reset. So tell us more. What do you mean exactly?
Well, thank you for reading that out loud. It's always nice to hear your words read by somebody. The problem is that the political system has, and the political discourse has changed so dramatically in the last decade or two, and the political media just hasn't kept up with it. And the biggest problem, of course, is the incredible spread of misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, and gaslighting. And the press simply hasn't recognized that it can't just do what it used to do when it's covering people who lie like that. They can't just say, well, here's the two views, you decide. They can't turn everything into an argument with two sides. They actually have to say, what they need to do desperately for the sake of the American public is tell people what's true and what's not, and to fight against the people who are lying to them. I mean, that's, you know, what a lot of us went into journalism for, was to fight, you know, fight for the truth. And they're not doing that enough.
So why is that, Dan? You've written about this over the years. I mean, even in the early 2010s. Why is this happening?
I wish I should do some sort of anthropological study here, but it's hard to say. I think a lot of it is simply inertia and defensiveness, maybe even defensiveness more than inertia. The folks who are in charge, if they made a radical break from the past, they would have to admit that they had made mistakes. And it's shocking to me. Journalists are a very defensive bunch, especially the higher on the elite, you know, media food chain they are. And they just don't want to change. And they think they're smarter than everybody else. They think that this position of aloofness, where they're not taking sides, gives them a certain kind of moral and intellectual superiority. And they're sort of hooked on that. And they won't recognize just the urgency of the situation and the urgency of all those issues that you talked about at the beginning of the show. I mean, we have a huge number of things we need to deal with here. And instead, we're just getting distracted by lies and you know, like the debt ceiling.
John, why don't you jump in here? What are your thoughts?
Well, I tend to agree with just about everything Dan has said, and I would only counsel that our political media has always been a mess. It has always been insufficient. Many years ago, Bob McChesney and I wrote a book on the death and life of American journalism. And in it, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what would be the best measure of a successful American political journalism. And of course, it would be 100% turnout in elections, right? I mean, everybody participates. Everybody is engaged. Now, that's not, you know, the ultimate measure of democracy. That's a baseline measure of democracy. But theoretically, if our journalism was sufficient to the moment in which we live, then, you know, everyone would be far more engaged with and participatory, not just in elections, but in all of civic life. The truth of the matter is that our political journalism historically and to this day tends to police the discourse in a way that dumbs it down, that narrows choices, that drives people out of the process, and that often provides people with so little information, so little real and valuable information, that they go searching elsewhere for it. Now, historically, what that meant was that they'd, you know, search for another newspaper or another radio station. But with the development of the internet, of course, people go everywhere. And I would argue because of so many failings by legacy media, traditional mainstream media, a tremendous number of people have, you know, gone searching in places on the internet where they've found a lot of misinformation, a lot of disinformation. And frankly, they've been manipulated by very powerful people who understand that there's a void, and they have filled that void with lies. Those lies have come to define our politics. Now we have people, you know, and the CEOs of major media companies and prominent journalists saying, oh, what will we do about disinformation? Well, I can tell you, the best thing you could do about disinformation and misinformation is to fill the void with dramatically more quality journalism that goes deeper, that asks tougher questions, and that always speaks truth to power.
And just also, can you both talk about why it's so difficult for many in the media to just call this for what it is? Dan, in your long piece, you cite that book by Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute and Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institute. These are not lefties, and they wrote a book in 2012 called It's Even Worse Than It Looks. It's about the rise of Republican Party extremism and the media's failure to adequately cover the transformation of the Republican Party. And what's so interesting is when they wrote that book in 2012, you point out that these two guys got so much media attention before the book came out, and then it stopped. And they actually said they had reporters call them and said, you know what, you're absolutely right. But their editors and producers said, you know, that, or they said they're concerned about the professional standing, the vulnerability of charges of partisan bias. And so reporters kept on with business as usual. And I think that just says a lot about 2012 to where we are today.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's one of the greatest sort of tells for political journalism. You know, Norm Ornstein, when I was at the Washington Post, you know, Norm Ornstein was like the ultimate guy you went to for quotes to get conventional wisdom really nicely put together in a soundbite. And by the time I was, you know, when I was at the Post in the early 2000s, reporters were no longer allowed to quote Norm Ornstein because he was quoted so much, not because he was saying crazy things. This guy is like Mr. Conventional Wisdom. And now he's, you know, he's been pointing out since 2012 that not only has the Republican Party, you know, lurched off the rails, but that the press won't acknowledge it. And yeah, he was, you know, he and Tom Mann were basically off of TV news for a while.
And then 2012 to today, John, last week, the Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan wrote a piece about Andrew Taylor, a Capitol Hill reporter with the Associated Press. After 30 years as a reporter, he quit. He said he's disgusted by what Congress has become. He's so traumatized by the January 6th riot, which he witnessed from inside the Capitol. Margaret Sullivan writes, although he calls the AP a wonderful, essential organization and praises his former colleagues in Washington journalism, he's become worried about traditional reporting, that it can't, or at least it doesn't, tell the full disturbing story. He said, the rules of objective journalism require you to present facts to tell a true story, but the objective journalism version of events can often obscure the reality of what's really going on here. John, this got a lot of attention because a man like this decided to leave and speak out. This just doesn't happen very often. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's highly significant, and there's a lot of thoughts on it. First and foremost, Margaret Sullivan is brilliant and a really, really important media commentator. If you haven't had her on, have her on. She is just terrific. And she's writing from within the belly of the beast. She used to write at the New York Times, now writes at the Washington Post, and often speaks a lot of truth to power. So I'm a big fan of hers, and I'm not surprised that she's the one who has this piece. Now, I think this is an important piece because it's sort of a, you know, like a good tell, a good reference to the crisis we're in. When the people who have the keys to the castle decide to throw the keys away and walk off, that's a big deal. That is telling us how bad the crisis is. We see that in politics, where some of our best and brightest people just give up on politics or don't even get engaged. We see that in journalism increasingly, where an awfully lot of people say, you know, well, this is absurd. What we're doing here is a joke. A couple of quick provisos, though. This notion that, well, traditional objective journalism doesn't work. Actually, I think traditional objective journalism has never been tried because, you know, objective journalism, right, is you're fair, you're true, you kind of go for the facts. Well, if you're fair, you're true, you go for the facts, you would have said in the mid-1960s, the Vietnam War shouldn't be fought, right? You would have said in the 1940s that, you know, racism has to be addressed immediately in this country. You know, there's all sorts of things that our so-called objective journalism hasn't gotten to the point of, right? It's not objective. It's actually avoidance journalism, and too often has avoided, you know, the heart and soul issues. So that's one component of it. And then one final thing I'll say about this is I think it's highly significant that a congressional correspondent has quit and said the things that have been said, and I don't want to diminish that at all. But I will tell you unequivocally, the crisis is not in Washington. The crisis is across this country. We are witnessing the rapid death of local and regional journalism. And local and regional journalism, sometimes we'll reference and cover what's going on in Washington, but it does so through the perspective of places across this country. As it collapses, as newspapers shut down, as radio stations get rid of their personnel, as a number of journalists literally diminishes by the day, you create a bigger void where people live. And the fundamental reality is that that's driving people toward the internet, of course, and they're going to get their information there anyway. But it's also driving more and more people toward, the dark corners of the internet, to places where they do get misinformation and lies, and where they are manipulated politically and otherwise. And so while I think it's a big deal that something like this has happened in Washington, I think it's a much bigger deal if, you know, like the woman who covers the school board in Keokuk, Iowa gives up.
Thanks. It wasn't depressing enough to talk about the failures of the National Press Corps. You have to talk about the only thing even more depressing, which is the demise of local news. That's just, I'm all cheered up now. I should mention, though, that actually I'm having an interview with Andrew Taylor, and that should be up on my website, presswatchers.org, next week. And I want to talk to him about, sort of what practical steps we could do, what we could do in the name of, you know, truly objective journalism to move away from the sort of triangulation that we do now and towards just telling people the truth a little bit more.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that, Dan. I mean, I try to read everything you write and everything you write, John. And I'm just wondering, Dan, I mean, you were in national media writing for The Washington Post. You also wrote for HuffPost and The Intercept. And then you started Press Watch. So you're writing on a regular basis. It's funded by donations from readers and the philanthropic community. I mean, why did you decide to go out on your own and do this?
Well, first of all, I should say that I was always a bit of an outsider, even when I was inside. I mean, mm-hmm. I was working at the Washington Post website as in the newsroom. And when I wrote my White House Watch column, I was actually a contractor working from home. And I think that was significant because I wasn't part of this organism that turns really good reporters into drones. Hmm. But so over time, I mean, as I was writing in my column about mostly about George Bush back at the Washington Post days, I found myself turning more and more towards media criticism, because what I was finding was that the coverage was just not adequate, that there were things being missed, that the whole story was missed. And you know, we talk about lies in Trump, the Trump era. The lies of the George W. Bush era were not as frequent, but they were certainly hugely numerous and potentially wildly more, you know, had more effect on lives and death. So it's always been a sort of a me watching the media as well as being in the media. And I felt like this was an area where there weren't enough people sort of speaking out for what is actually a fairly consistent critique among, you know, from a lot of readers and a lot of academics and a lot of journalists. Now, it's happened that the space has gotten quite busy over time. It used to be just, you know, John Nichols and me. But it's now, you know, there's now a lot more press criticism, which is great.
And what about you, John? I mean, you've been at this for a while. What do you see your role during this time? I mean, what I love about your reporting, we've been covering the reconciliation bill for weeks now, and you have two really good pieces on this. One, AOC would have cast the winning vote for drug price reform. We just talked about that yesterday, trying to give people tips on how to fight high drug bills. You write, top Democrats blocked her in favor of centrist Kathleen Rice, who voted with Big Pharma instead. And then your latest piece, has Big Pharma bought enough Democrats to derail Biden's plan? If Dems allow the party's mansion and cinema wing to derail prescription drug pricing reforms, they could lose their ability to govern.
Exactly right. And look, your question, of course, is the one every journalist always wants to get, which is, you know, why do you do the things you do the way you do? And my answer to that is that I'm always interested. I don't think I do that much that's different than other journalists, except I always try to answer the next question, not the first question. You know, the first question is the top line thing that you hear in the 30-second news blurb on a radio station, you know, this before, you know, some great show like this comes on. And it'll be, oh, well, it looks like, you know, Biden's $3.5 trillion reconciliation plan may be in trouble. And, you know, Democrats are divided and people go to the White House to have meetings. And so that's your top line. And I'll let other people do that. I'm always interested in why. Why is it in trouble? Biden's not the greatest thing since sliced bread, but, you know, he came up actually here with a, you know, pretty good plan. It's a compromise plan, not a radical one. But what's it talking about? Giving older folks vision, dental, and hearing care as part of Medicare. I mean, who's against that? Giving workers, you know, paid sick and family leave. Who's against that? You know, providing affordable college education. I mean, who's against that? I mean, these are all staggeringly popular things, and then you ladle on a little saving the planet, which I understand is quite popular in California right now. And you think, you know, I mean, how could this bill be stumbling? How could it be in trouble? Well, the answer, of course, is that very, very rich people have two problems with it. Number one, it might make them a little less rich, i.e., it might, you know, regulate Big Pharma and stuff like that. And two, it might ask them to actually pay their fair share of taxes. And so that's what's going on. That's the story. And the weird part of it is, Rose and Dan, if our media was covering, you know, just the interventions and the twists of Big Pharma with the intensity that they're covering, you know, whether, you know, Joe Manchin likes Bernie Sanders, right? The personality stuff and you know, just the numbers. If they actually looked at the heart of the matter, the $3.5 trillion plan would have passed weeks ago. It'd be all done. It'd be, you know, we'd all be, anybody over 65 would be getting their dental care.
Yeah, exactly. And again, we should say $3.5 trillion over 10 years, which is usually missing from the conversations. But the fact that this is life-changing for so many, millions and millions of people, we've gone over every detail in this bill. And if yes, it is still being worked out. But the major components would really be life-changing. And yet we just watched Bernie on Good Morning America recently, and you know, the same question over and over again. Are you going to bring the number down? Why is it so high? Are you going to work with Manchin? And he tries, you can see, he tries so hard to say, can we please just talk about the dental aspects of this, the glasses? And they go right back to the number with hardly any context about how the tax system has drastically been transformed over the past 40 years. Whereas, you know, middle class people typically pay more than the wealthy. Dan, what are your thoughts? What can we do to get out of this? Like you said, you're going to be interviewing the reporter who recently left the AP, and I'm sure you're going to talk about this kind of thing, but what will it take to actually focus more on issues? Because if you tell people what's in it, they can maybe start calling their politician and say, yeah, I want that.
I'm afraid it'll take a new generation of newsroom leadership, if that. I mean, I don't see the people, you know, running. Well, we had two new leaders at the Washington Post and the LA Times, which is promising, but we haven't seen any change from them. Dean Baquet at the New York Times is the ultimate defender of sort of this current system. What they need to do, I mean, what I'd love to see, and I actually on my website have like a, I prepared a speech for what a new news leader should do when they're coming into a major newsroom. It'd be telling the political reporters, you're government reporters. You're not political reporters. Your job is to actually cover whether an idea is a good one or a bad one, figuring out what the problems are and then what the solutions are and looking at who's getting in the way of the solutions. It's a totally different way of doing business than just covering politics as a sport. But that's what they do. I mean, there was an article in Politico the other day about Kristen Sinema's objecting to the Farmist stuff. And it never mentioned why, what her argument was, because she doesn't even have one. She's just... They don't care either. They don't care about the why. And that's, you know, John Nichols was talking about that. The why is the important thing. The why, and the why of the lie. I mean, the why behind the lying. Mm-hmm. So I wish they would ask why more than what.
We have about a minute left. John, to your point about what's happening at the local level, you reminded me of a really devastating piece I just read in The Guardian about these local conservative talk show hosts that most of us have never heard of. They're in Daytona Beach, Florida. They're in Tennessee. Five of these guys have died of COVID. They were all anti-vax, anti-mask. And it's sad because this is where a lot of people do get their news. And they're like a Rush Limbaugh, but we've just never heard of them because they're at the local level. But they have massive influence. So in our remaining minute, John, given that about the state of the local media, you know, where does this leave people who need this information? Because the people who rely on these guys for information would greatly benefit from Medicare expansion.
Without a doubt. In fact, they'd greatly benefit from things like, you know, funding caregiving so that if they or their elderly parents need care in their home or in a some sort of nursing facility, they could get it without going bankrupt. I mean, the thing is that our political discourse at this point is a manufactured discourse. And, you know, Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman wrote about manufacturing consent years ago. That was mainly thought of at the federal level. The big innovation of the last, you know, 50 years has been that the manufacturing of consent has now gone down into the grassroots of this country. And there are baseline models for how you create a local conservative talk radio show. All sorts of people know how to do it. You don't have to be that talented, although some of them are very talented. But what you have to do is, you know, get on those talking points every day, drive it home in the most entertaining way you can, and fill the void that's been created by the shutting down of the news operation on that station. So it isn't just one of the things is people get all excited about right-wing talk radio. What they fail to recognize is the reason right-wing talk radio fills so much of the space out there is because everything else is gone. We have news deserts in hundreds of communities, hundreds of counties across this country where people get their information at best from right-wing talk radio. And then beyond that, heading off into the internet for conspiracy theories that even right-wing talk radio won't talk about.
Well, and this is why it's so important to support independent media. We're going to continue this conversation. I'm sorry we're out of time. John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch. John and Dan, thank you both for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Support Press Watch.
Support read John Nichols.
Yes, thank you. Support your independent media. Thank you both so much. Coming up a break, we will talk about media coverage of taxes. We'll talk about ProPublica's major tax investigation. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.